Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. At age 23, Drew Philp moved to Detroit and bought a house for $500. He spent the next few years renovating it, living without heat or electricity. Drew wrote a book about this experience called A $500 House in Detroit, Rebuilding an Abandoned Home and an American City. He talks this hour with WTCM News Talk 580 radio host Ron Jolly. Ron asked Drew where he grew up. This event was recorded at the Traverse City Opera House in April 2018.
I grew up in Adrian, Michigan, which is about here on the hand, to a pretty blue-collar family. My father was a tradesman, and he taught machine trades at a Votech, at a tech center. I was lucky enough to be able to go to the University of Michigan, and at the time, I graduated in 2008, and at the time, everyone was leaving the state. Like 75% of U of M graduates were leaving the state. This is at the height of the Great Recession. And I felt very, very lucky to get the education that I did, coming from the family that I did. And I wanted to use that for something positive at home. So that's when I decided to move to Detroit, and everybody told me I was throwing my life away.
Yeah. What are you doing that for? Why did you move to Detroit? How familiar were you with Detroit, especially the area that you moved in?
So I was really not familiar at all. The time I'd spent in Detroit was going to like dirty punk shows at clubs, and then you'd go in and out. So I didn't have a lot of familiarity. But the reason I moved there was because, you know, Detroit is not only the heartbeat of Michigan and the Midwest, it is arguably the heartbeat of the United States itself. It was the city that invented the middle class with Henry Ford and his $5 a day. It was the America's fourth largest city at one point, and now it's not even in the top 20.
Yeah.
And it has this metaphorical power that other cities just don't have. Practically, it also meant that what I did in Detroit would reverberate around the state and around the region, you know, to my cousin framing out houses in Kalamazoo, or my sister who's a nurse in Lansing. Mm.
Detroit, though, I remember a friend of mine gave me a sweatshirt years ago, and the graphic was you were looking down the barrel of a pistol, and it said, "Welcome to Detroit, where the weak are killed and eaten."
Yeah.
So it kind of has that image, and you're moving in at a real downturn in the economy.
Sure, certainly.
Did you have a goal at that point when you first moved there?
You know, what I had said at that point was, I don't know what I want to do, but I know that I want to do that in Detroit.
Just wanted to be in Detroit.
That was my goal, to stay in Michigan all costs. Because like I said, I felt really lucky to get this world-class education. And I really wanted to use it to try to do something at home for my people here. You know, everybody seemed to be moving to New York or San Francisco or Paris. And I'm a Michigan boy. My whole family's from here. We all live here. I thought that was important that I stuck around.
So you moved to, which I didn't know they don't call it the Cass Corridor anymore, but that's where you moved and had crack dealers and prostitutes as your neighbors?
That's true, yeah. Yes. It was Detroit is changing now. Detroit is a very different place than it was even 10 years ago. But at the time, it was the Detroit that everybody here thinks of, and that was real. However, no one ever treated me poorly. I got treated wonderfully by all kinds of people. I lived in an apartment building in the corridor, and my neighbors were literally crack dealers and prostitutes and former prostitutes that would look out for me, that had kind of taken a shine to me. And we would sit on the stoop and drink, and I smoked cigarettes at the time. And smoke, and everyone really looked out for me.
Yep. So, although a big change from Ann Arbor, from Lenawee County, Adrian area, welcoming, and then you took the next step of laying down roots and buying a house. What led you to say, "Not I'm going to buy a house, but I'm going to buy one that's barely standing for $500, and I'm going to bring it to life"? What made you do that?
So I was working in construction. I was sanding floors for $8.50 an hour, laying floors. I really like the people I work with, but that's a real hard job, especially for that kind of money. And I was working in all these cheap rentals that people were buying, because you could buy a house for nothing at the time. You still can Detroit. And that kind of got me thinking, like, wow, why am I paying rent? Mm-hmm. Making $8.50 an hour, I should buy one of these and live in it. I thought, one, it was a good financial decision, but also that it would keep me tied to Detroit and Michigan because, you know, everything I owned at that time would fit in my Jeep, and I could go. And Detroit's not the easiest city to live in still, so I wanted something that tied me there.
What was the neighborhood that you moved into, Poletown or Poletown East?
Sure.
Is it Poletown? What was it like in 08 when you first went there and met some of the people who had bought and rehabbed some of these houses? What, I mean, can you paint a picture of how many houses on a block, what the conditions were?
Sure, so if anybody here is familiar with Detroit, I live in Poletown. It's just east of Eastern Market. And it is a triangle, it's in a triangle bordered by freeways and Gratiot Avenue, which is a main thoroughfare, that's only residential. And that neighborhood has a population density of 90% less than Detroit as a whole. Detroit is already a half-empty city, and that's even less. At the time when I moved in there, you could throw a stone in any direction and hit an abandoned house. Hmm. And these are legitimately abandoned houses. I did look at some foreclosures, three-story brick houses that I could have bought and moved into for $3,000. But I couldn't bring myself to profit off of someone else's misery like that. One in three houses in Detroit has been foreclosed on. And that's not a crisis of personal responsibility when it's one in three. That's something systemic and wrong. So the neighborhood was positively rural except for these kind of crumbling American ruins. I don't think there was anything like it elsewhere in the United States, just these tombstones of houses. That people had once loved and once cared for were just abandoned. I used to be able to walk my dog. This is a bike ride from the baseball stadium in one of America's largest and most important cities and not be able to see a soul for an hour.
What kind of wildlife was out in the neighborhood there?
This is true. Yeah. So a kind of mascot for Detroit is now the pheasant because we have pheasants. Pheasants are big birds. I've seen foxes. I almost hit one on my motorcycle. Uh-huh. Actually, that was not that great. My buddy Will, who's a character in my book, swears that he saw a deer. Again, this is a major American city. I sit out on the porch at night with my girlfriend, and we listen to the crickets and the insects.
Yep. So I want to ask about Will because Drew's story it strikes me because it's just a matter of kind of following your heart, following your principles, not really knowing where it's going to lead you, and it led him here to the stage of the National Writers Series. He does TED Talks in New York and travels the world and writes for The Guardian. And you didn't know that when you got out of school. You just followed yourself. So tell me about how you met Will and how that kind of led you to buy one of these houses.
So to be honest with you, I kind of thought that I might have been throwing my life away too. I certainly did not expect any of this, nor did I expect to write a book.
Yeah.
But meeting Will is an interesting kind of story. I was living in an apartment and I really didn't have many friends. I was very, very lonely. I moved to Detroit with no money, no job, and no friends at all. Just basically with nothing, with what I had in my back almost. And I decided to go to a Halloween party dressed as an organ grinder, like an old-timey organ grinder that like grinds the organ, right? And I made this pretty sweet organ that played Motown music. Mm. And because I was making $8.50 an hour, I had hidden some liquor inside the organ to drink at the party, so I didn't have to buy it, which is kind of shameful, but I don't regret it. So I had set my organ down to go dance. I really like to dance, interestingly enough. And I had come back to get an illicit swig of this Rock Gut whiskey, and sitting next to my organ was a person dressed up as an organ grinder's monkey. honestly, and it seemed very, very meant to be. And he was kind of all knotted up and uncomfortable. He's really a misanthrope. And he didn't want to be there. We went outside and began talking. And I said, I want to buy a house in East Detroit, in this neighborhood that I'd kind of been exploring on my own. And he said, I just did. It seemed very meant to be. He had lived in Detroit a decade before that, so 20 years ago, and was like, Kid Rock had lived in the same building downtown. It was a really pretty wild time, and he had been traveling the country. He was kind of a punk, so he was like riding freight trains around and living in Asheville and New Orleans, and he had come back and purchased this house for $3,000 from a Detroit police officer. It was his mother's house, and she had died in there. It was the only house in the block except for a weird, ugly project house that was across the street that somebody had built and also abandoned.
So you read, when you saw Will's home, you said, it's the coolest thing I've ever seen, and to you it equaled freedom.
Yeah, it was like a tree house, right? You know, I was 23, and you can buy a house for $3,000 or $5,000, and he was living there. When he got there, you know, he didn't have any water, so he was mopping the floor with rainwater and just kind of figuring things out, really divorced from what was going on in the rest of American culture. So I lived with him that summer. He let me live with him while I was looking for a house for free, which was very, very kind. And we were very cut off from things. So it was before smartphones. Yeah. So neither of us had a smartphone. We didn't have the internet. We certainly didn't have television. The only kind of connection to the outside world we had was the radio.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful. It was one of the most beautiful times in my life. But from that, we would ride our bikes just around the neighborhood and look for houses and go into these abandoned houses and look for something that looked good.
And so you found one there. And back to motive here. So you're 23 and it looks like a treehouse and you can make your own and you can buy it cheap and carve out your own life in Detroit. And there's more of a statement, too, that I think you make throughout your book. Zeno, I want to ask you about Zeno, was a crack dealer from the old place where you first lived. Mm. And you write, he invited you, he called you up one day and says, can you go to the hospital with me? And they had a little chapel in the hospital, I guess, and Zeno and his wife or girlfriend had a service for their stillborn baby, and they invited you along. What impact did that have on you, and how did that inspire you, if at all, to stay in Detroit?
Oh, man, I forgot about that until just now. That was hard. So Sino and his girlfriend, Sue, I call them in the book, had a stillborn baby, and they invited me to the funeral, and it was a 3-4-person funeral. There was a preacher, and there was Sino and Sue, and there was me. I think Sino wanted to show me something. And I don't know exactly what that was, but I remember that baby staring at me. It's an image that I have burned into my brain that I will never be able to forget. Because Sue wanted to see her son for the last time before they put him in the ground. They took all of the blankets off the child. And it had... Sorry, this is a little difficult, you know. It convinced me that how can you leave? How can you leave that? I've been given so much privilege and had so much luck and worked so hard to get the education that I do and to read and have a family that supports me almost unconditionally. My parents are just wonderful, strange people. So to have that, I realized that I just couldn't go. I couldn't go away.
That's a weird feeling, though. Did you feel some kind of obligation to some individuals you knew, or to just symbolically to some people that you would abandon them if you left Detroit?
Yeah. So the Detroit is a city of leaving. You know, people just leave, and that's really what the problem is, right? When you get down to it, it's that simple and that complex. I don't think it's obligation. I think it's responsibility is what I think. And I think that I have a responsibility not only to Detroit and to Michigan, but to the United States and our world. I think we're facing a lot of enormous challenges right now. And I always think that I can't really be free unless my neighbors are free as well. So when I'm watching my neighbors get foreclosed on and people losing their homes at a rate of 1 out of every 3, and also people losing their water, at 1 out of every 6 homes in Detroit has lost access to fresh water. This is on the world's largest source of it. You can spit into the world's largest source of fresh water from Detroit. There was a huge responsibility to that, and you can never really be free when you're seeing this. I think that's a lesson that we've forgotten in this country a little bit.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Ron Jolly's conversation with Drew Philp.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Ron Jolly's conversation with Drew Philp.
So it would have been easy to leave, maybe for a lot of people, to say this is too much of a hassle, it's too depressing.
Sure.
I just want to get out and use my degree and get a nice job, but
you did not. I don't know, it sounds foolish and silly, I suppose, and old-fashioned maybe, but I try to do the right thing, and that's what my parents taught me, and I don't know, it's the truth, and it's that simple, and it's that complex.
So the neighborhood you described, it was kind of rural, it's right outside of downtown Detroit, stone's throw from the freeway, and there, farming is going on there. People are farming.
Yeah, people are farming. We're baling hay.
Yeah, you were baling hay out there.
Right, yeah.
Fields of alfalfa. What was that, I don't know, 50 years ago, say, do you know what the neighborhood was before it became what it is?
Sure, 50 years ago, the neighborhood, their houses would have been packed in like matchsticks.
Yeah.
It is an ethnically Polish neighborhood, although before that it was an Italian neighborhood, and before that it was a Jewish neighborhood. There are two churches on the National Register of Historic Places in the neighborhood. One is St. Stanislaus, which is completely abandoned and wide open.
Hmm.
The other is St. Albertus, which they're trying to bring back, and they use maybe once a month. People legitimately used to mortgage their homes to build these churches. People loved this place. They were built to rival the cathedrals in Europe, so I'm talking like gold leaf and marble. And it was one of the original areas of white flight, and people moved away, in many cases literally abandoning their house, which is what I bought. My house had been abandoned for at least 10 years.
So do you feel what you did and what your neighbors there did by rehabbing these houses and staying put with all the challenges is a credit to, or it's bringing the city back? I mean, you feel like, suppose 100,000 people did that, what shape the city would be in?
I mean, I think we should certainly support it. And we also need to support the people that are actually there and have stuck around, too. I couldn't have done any of this without the people that have stuck around. There's sometimes a thought when we get to talking about these kind of pioneer things that, that I'm a pioneer. I'm not. There were people there way, way before me, people that have stuck around, seen a lot harder things that I have, and they deserve a lot of credit too. And sometimes there's also a myth that those people can't move out, and that's just what it is, a myth. People that have been in Detroit, I call them generational Detroiters, for a long time, they very much care about the city too. And we need to have, they need to have a large role in deciding what the city becomes as it's changing. And I think that as a society, governments need to support not only the new folks like me coming in, but the people that have been there for a while too.
Mm-hmm. What the knock on Detroit is the safety issue, the crime issue. What can you tell us about that in your neighborhood or living there? Is that a legitimate issue, or did you have to deal with any threats or crime?
Sure. Yes. I mean the safety is always a legitimate issue. It is a dangerous city. There are like 3 carjackings a day or something there. However, crime generally stays within its own group. Despite what the news says, crime is generally not random. Although that does happen, sometimes that happens. The vast majority of crime is not random. So it is, in that sense, much safer. With that said, nobody there is untouched by crime. People don't have jobs, there's nothing for young men to do or to feel good about, and they largely have no other choice. So I did have someone try to kick in my door one day, and that was terrifying. Not only in the fact that I was scared for myself and my own personal safety, I had a gun, and I would have shot that person had he, I assume it was a he, I never saw the person, come into my house. That's a huge thing. You go to Detroit and you want to do good, and then you end up shooting someone. That's not great.
You were reluctant to get a gun, weren't you?
I was a little bit. I grew up, in a rural family. Like we grew up hunting and fishing and stuff. And I had to make a kind of real decision about that. And I cannot get the police to come to my house when I call them. I mean, maybe they would come sometimes. The last time my neighbor called the police on my behalf, I generally do not call the police for a number of reasons. but they did not show up.
Yeah. So your experience with the police in that neighborhood overall was not good?
I mean,
or just an incident or two?
I mean, these men and women are doing a really difficult job. Yep. So my dad was I certainly don't hate the police. My dad was a police officer in the summers. I have two uncles that were police officers. The starting salary for a Detroit cop is just wildly low.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like $12 an hour or something. I mean, it's something ridiculous. Yeah. Don't quote me on that number, but it is something
low.
Absurdly low. They're doing a really difficult job. You know, it's definitely not the beat cop's fault that, you know, that they're coming. They got a lot of stuff to do. But there has been some serious mismanagement on the governmental level. And that's not just Detroit. That's the state of Michigan, and that's the federal government, that, you know, we're not providing adequate resources for the most basic of necessities of our citizens in America. I mean, think about that. That's terrifying. You know, during the bankruptcy, we cut back the pensions of people who had worked for, in some cases, 30 years for the city, and were promised that as part of their salary, and we cut that back. It's terrifying to me that America can't make its promises.
Live up to the obligations there. I was going to say, too, with the safety feature, so if on your block, if there were just the residents who were left, who had been there a long time and left, and nobody knew like yourself and your friends that you met there and rehab these houses, it probably would have been a prime area for crime. I mean, was it a positive impact that you feel that you guys had just by bringing some vibrancy to the neighborhood?
You know, I think so. I think it's I'm certainly not gonna claim that. You know, what I did was I took one abandoned house. Nobody can get dragged into that house. That house can't burn down. Now, it can burn down still, but not in some kind of abandonment thing. Sure, it's definitely safer with more eyes, but I'm certainly not gonna take credit for, you know, the safety of the neighborhood. It's really a team effort. So I have many of my neighbors are elderly, and you know, they help out. They're, you know, sitting on the porch a lot when it's nice out, and they're keeping eyes on everything. They're around during the day when people are at work. Myself, another young man that in the book I call King. If there's problems, we deal with them. I'm not gonna send my elderly old female neighbor to, you know, talk to the guy scrapping the house out, right? That's kind of my job. So we all work together.
So I was gonna say, so when there's vibrancy in the neighborhood, does it become a target because now there are people that have things that, or is it the reverse effect where they know you're looking out for each other?
I think they know we're looking out for each other, but in my neighborhood in particular, I don't see too big of a problem with that yet. What I do see is in the city at large. Mm-hmm. So as more young white people move into the city, we're having classes rub up against each other in a way that they were not before. So you have some people who are, in many cases, in desperate, near third world poverty. We're talking about people without water. Next to people working for Dan Gilbert and tech people making, you know, in some cases $100,000 a year. They're looking to Detroit as a place that is exciting. And when you have those things rub up against each other, the have and the have-nots, that can cause problems.
All right. Well, what's your thought about then? I mean, if you've seen that and see that as a problem, what could we do about that?
I think the first and foremost, the money that we spend there needs to be allocated more responsibly. So just a week after Detroit declared bankruptcy, a week after Detroit said it was a bankrupt city, we gave Mike Ilitch, the owner of the Red Wings and the Tigers, $350 million to build a hockey stadium. Economists agree on basically nothing, and this is conservative and liberal economists, this crosses all divides, and agree that is a raw deal. So I think that if we really want Detroit to come back for everyone, for Detroiters, and in addition to people coming in, because, you know, like myself, we can allocate that, we can use that money a lot more sensibly and a lot more critically, frugally, and innovatively. So for example, Detroit is a food desert, which means that people have trouble getting access to fresh food. I have trouble getting access to fresh food. I have to drive quite a ways to get to a grocery store. With that money, Detroit could have planted fruit trees around the city, free for everyone to eat from. Detroit could have put solar panels on everyone's house, basically.
What would you say, is that 700, $500,000 loans, how, what would you get out of that? Or,
and that's, you know, if we want to keep it in capitalism, we want to keep it in that money in economic development. So, you can make $700,500,000
grants,
small
actually.
Business grants and loans, right? That's a lot of money. Detroit would be a completely different place with 700 new small businesses. This is stuff that we can do on the state and national level too. We can think like this and we can support people that are sitting out in the audience right now to do things instead of giving money to a billionaire for a hockey stadium that doesn't really change anything.
I lived downtown 1979 through 83-ish, and Jefferson Avenue, I'm trying to think of a cross street, well, right by I-75 there. When I went shopping, I had a Farmer Jack's, which was terrible. It was just a really dirty store, and it was not always open when it was supposed to be. So I went to the Burbs to go shopping, which was the case right until I think Whole Foods. I mean, where did you go shop for grocery shopping?
There is one great independent grocery store there called Honeybee Market, which is in Southwest, which is like the Mexican part of towns. It's near what we call Mexican Town. Honeybee Market was great, so I usually went to Honeybee. And there is also some great independent grocery stores in Hamtramck, ethnic grocery stores, Polish and Islamic grocery places that are just great. But until 2009, the last Farmer Jack closed there, and I forget what year it was. Until 2009, Detroit didn't have a single national chain grocery store until Whole Foods came. And Whole Foods itself is perhaps, and I'm guessing here, the most subsidized grocery store in the United States. It was subsidized on the federal, the state, and the city levels.
Whole Foods?
That's correct.
How through?
All of those, so federal, state, and city. Is a subsidized
level. That they get for building there.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Whole paycheck, they call it.
Whole paycheck.
Because it's not affordable for everybody.
Yes, I call it food hole.
So I want to talk a bit about your writing, because this is the Writers Conference here. And before we get to that, talk about building. So you enmesh yourself in Detroit. You make the decision to be there for pretty principled reasons, passionate reasons. But realistically, you have a piece of junk. You have a beautiful frame, a Queen Anne with no plumbing, no electricity, no windows, big holes in the roof.
Sure.
Did you have look at it and wonder, could you really, did you have the knowledge and the fortitude to actually follow through and fix this and make it livable? Did you have doubts at any time?
I don't remember that I did. I'm sure that I did at some point, but I was probably excited for the challenge. You know, like when I was a kid, we used to build stuff. We used to build tree forts, and that's what we did for fun. I mean, I grew up in a family where there was like, you know, like you knew which end of the hammer to hold, which is not always the case anymore. The days of the, you know, shop in grandpa's basement are going away. But I grew up, and that's what I did for fun, so I was legitimately excited about working on this and testing myself. You know, I think we're seeing a crisis in masculinity right now, especially in young men. I think that's where a lot of these mass shootings are coming from. It's basically always all men. And we don't really have any rituals to place us into manhood anymore, to be able to test ourselves. The military is only 1% of families now. There's no draft, nothing like that. So we're not able to exercise our, you know, what is, you know, traditional masculinity. So I was very excited about that, and I was very excited to kind of take this on. You know, now at 31, I like definitely would not want to live without heat for 2 years. But at the time, it was, you know, you want to test yourself, and I wanted to see what kind of human being I was going to be.
So what was your favorite tool? Did you have a go-to tool or one that you always said, I'm really thankful I have this?
You know, I have a favorite screwdriver, which is like the stupidest thing. It's like this little red screwdriver that I got at like a little market down there. And man, it just works perfectly. It like fits right in the slots and like feels good in your hand.
Yep.
I remember telling my buddy Chris, a buddy of mine who was helping me on the house, that's my favorite screwdriver. And he was like, okay, Drew, I'm not going to break it.
Yeah. Well, I asked you on the radio, and you mentioned today, that to me seemed like a lonely existence at first. And maybe I'm thinking of Tom Hanks and Wilson and his volleyball, you know, and you had that screwdriver. But no, it did seem to move downtown. You didn't bring your friends, girlfriend, family. It was just you, and then you moved into this neighborhood all by yourself. You made friends, but that takes a little while to warm up and actually feel that relationship. So you stuck to it there. What was the biggest challenge for you construction-wise with the house?
Heat. The heat, really. The heat. So I lived without heat for 2 years, as I just imagined, almost 2 years, as I just mentioned. And that cold just works its way into you. It was something that I both wanted to do and needed to do. I legitimately did not have the money for heat. And the house in which I was staying, the people were letting me rent for free for looking after it, but it didn't have heat. And that was really tough. I was eating incredible amounts of food. Because you don't realize how much your body is a furnace until you don't have heat. I lost all kinds of weight just trying to keep myself warm. And just the brutal, unending cold of Michigan winters, gets to you. You know, I'd take the like 15, 20 minute showers because it would be the warmest part of my day. I would, sleep in my Carhartt jacket underneath so many blankets my dad thought I was going to asphyxiate.
Yeah. So you finally got heat, though, and again, Drew, if you read the book here, he wanted to do this on his own with integrity. You didn't want to go buy cheap materials made in Asia at the big box store. You wanted to patronize the locals. You wanted to salvage and reuse whatever you could. And you had a lot of pride in doing it, with help from your community, of course, your friends. But then your dad and your grandma kind of blew that by saying, "We bought you a furnace."
They did. They did. So that's how I got a furnace. And at the time, I was, I wanted to do it myself. But I learned an important lesson there. And it took me a while to realize this, that being part of a community doesn't mean just giving because I'm the baddest dude in town, and I'm helping everybody and helping myself. It means accepting graciously, too. And that was something that, it took me a while to learn. And I try to remember that now. Who am I to not take a gift or something like that.
So that's probably one of the many things you learned through this experience.
I learned a lot of things. Yeah. I had a lot of growing up to do.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Drew Philp talks about how he turned his experience renovating an abandoned home in Detroit into a book deal.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Ron Jolly's conversation with Drew Philp, author of A $500 House in Detroit.
When did you start writing about this? I mean, did you keep a blog or a journal, or when did you decide to tell this story?
Sure. I kept journals throughout, just as a habit to, things would be rattling around in my brain, and to not go insane, I would write them down. I was working on a film and had the film fall through, and most importantly, I had the money from that film fall through, and I really needed a job. I took a job writing advertising copy for like lawyers' websites. It was awful.
Call 1-800.
No offense to the lawyers out there, but it wasn't my favorite thing to do. And so in my downtime at that job, I wrote a pitch to BuzzFeed, the website. About just my story about building my house and how Detroit was changing and what that had to do with the rest of the United States and in the world in a lot of cases, and eventually BuzzFeed accepted that pitch, It took quite a long time writing a story. I think I wrote it like a 6,500-word story, mm-hmm. which took people about as long as a TV show to read. Mm. It was very long. And about 2 million people read that story in just a couple of days.
So that means on the internet, I mean, for those who don't surf or play on the web a lot, if I read it and say, man, I'm really impressed by this, I might put it on my Facebook page and share it with others. So it just passed around. 2 million people read it.
Yeah, approximately. It wasn't quite 2 million people, but you know, approximately. Lots and lots of people read it.
Lots of people read it. Yeah, that's a big audience.
and so that was the first time I'd written about my story. And from that, I had a number of agents contact me, and from that we wrote a book proposal and sold the book. I had been a journalist before that. I'd worked for the Free Press and Bakersfield, California, and a great newspaper in California as an intern. And so I had some writing experience beforehand.
So again, it goes to graduating from the University of Michigan, proud to have one of the first people in your family, one of the first to get a college degree?
My parents went to college.
Okay. Yeah. Well, one of the first generations there, but University of Michigan, notable university. Deciding to move downtown to the Cass Corridor, not really sure why, meeting people, crack dealers, going to the Halloween party alone dressed as an organ grinder and meeting a monkey who owned a house and knew the process to buy a house, which is what you wanted to do, and hanging out and peddling around and finding the house and then surviving how many years was it, 2-3 years?
Before I wrote that BuzzFeed story?
From the time you got the house till the time it was pretty much completed.
So I'm still yeah. working on it. You know, it's never really going to be done, right? Anybody's built this? So my grandfather built his own house, my uncle built his own house, and my grandfather just cut his thumb off on the table saw at 90-something, or not all the way off, but my grandma made him go to the hospital, you know, and he's still moving walls 2 feet, right? Because he just wants it a little bit better. It's very nice and very comfortable and mostly done. But
all of that, and then to say, well, I think I'm going to make a pitch to BuzzFeed. They accept it. People love it. Agents contact you. You don't call them. The publishing literature agents literary agents contact you, and it turns out it's a good idea because there's a bidding war.
Sure.
You get a contract, there's the book.
There was the writing of the book in between that, which was the difficult
part. Well,
I
was just going to ask about it. So how does writing a book compare to rehabbing a Queen Anne?
So I thought it was going to be super easy, right? After doing the house, I was like, oh, this is going to be a breeze. I just got to write it all down. Writing the book was way harder than doing the actual house. Writing the book is definitely the hardest thing that I have ever done.
What was difficult about that?
I don't know. You have to spend a lot of time alone, and you really have to like the person that you're with when you're alone. So I would spend literally weeks without talking to anybody. I could do 2 weeks, and I think it kind of altered my personality, actually. I'm much more of an introvert now than I was, believe it or not. Just to dredge up do that emotional labor and dredge up those memories and be in that place, and the, you know, heartache, but also accomplishments, it's exhausting. It's exhausting to relive those things over again and relive them, you know, for the benefit of somebody else and try to draw these lessons and things to make a positive impact on my community.
Do you have to decide, too, how much you want to reveal about your life?
Sure.
I mean, you shared a bit about an intimate relationship you had with somebody and about a lot of your emotions, but at some point as a writer, do you say, oh, that's mine, I'm not sharing that?
If I can be of use to the world, I try to do that. If I don't try to do anything gratuitously, but you know, if it's they say that you should write about what you don't want to write about because that's important. So, you know, with some of these things, if I can be of use, I try to offer what I can. That's how they let poor kids write. They let you write about yourself. You gotta write about yourself first before they'll let you write about anything else.
Did you do an outline, or did the publisher, the editor, give you an idea of how to work your way through this?
So I had some training in terms of structuring long form things like this when I was doing movies. So I that was also an interesting story where I was working at the Free Press had spelled my byline wrong. And I was working at as a result, I started working at a French restaurant in town. It was this wild place. It was this guy, this like 8 foot tall French soccer star, married a Detroit woman and opened this like weird French cafe in the middle of this like industrial neighborhood. It was wild and a whole lot of fun. Anyways, I was working as a chef, and it was an open kitchen, so we would kind of talk to the patrons, and there was this one gentleman that would come in every day. And he would order the exact same thing every day, and I still remember what his order was. It was a ham and Swiss crepe with a fruit salad instead of a regular salad. Wouldn't fail. And, you know, one day we got talking, and he said, I'm a filmmaker. I have this very short script. I can't pay you, but do you want to look at it? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'm not doing anything. So I gave him some notes and changed some things around and gave it back to him. He said, oh, that was a test. Do you want a job? And I said, yes, I do. So he paired me with himself, who was a good and an Emmy-winning filmmaker, Michigan winning filmmaker. And I learned a lot about structure that way.
Okay.
And then so when we built the proposal that my agent sold, that there was a structure in that proposal, what kind of every chapter was going to look like.
Okay.
By the end of the book, none of that structure remained at all. it was much different. I have a wonderful, brilliant editor named Colin Harrison, who's kind of a legend in the business, and he really was very nice and helped me through things. And the first time I talked to him, on the phone about the book, I'd met him once before, he said, you know, I'm really sorry to do this, but we're totally going to blow the structure of your book up. I said, okay, I'll listen to whatever you have to say.
So I remember in the book, right about the time you got the furnace from your dad and grandmother, you write about your parents are over there, and they're in the house helping you clean up or do something, and they have their coats on, and it's freezing, and they're saying, you can't live like this anymore.
Right.
And you're the one that they sent to college and decided not to do anything with your degree, traditionally. And now you're living in this house. What do they think of you now?
Oh, they're so excited. They're so happy. So I, like I said, I had weird, strange parents who used to send me like NAACP meetings so I could get, I grew up in a very small place and they recognized that. And like when we went on vacation, they took us to Europe once and we went to like Dachau concentration camp so we could see how the world works. We took all these like educational vacations, Colonial Williamsburg. If you've never been to Colonial Williamsburg, it is sweet. So they have always been extremely supportive. But as I tell young writers, if there's any young writers in here, there's a point in every writer's life where the only person that believes in you is you. Even my parents, who are the best parents in the world, there was a point where they're like, you should probably get a job. So there were some low points, but they of course they're super proud. They like watch me on TV and look up all this stuff, and they want to talk about it. And I'm like, it's weird, I don't want to. But they, I love them very much. I could not have asked for better parents.
What did building the house? I say building it. Rehabbing it, but it really was more like a construction job.
So I say building because everything is new.
What did that do for you, that young 23-year-old, maybe a bit idealistic, maybe a bit naive, and after accomplishing that, what did it do for you? It must have given you confidence to go out and deal with the world like this and sit on a stage and talk to people.
I suppose it does. What it gave me was discipline. Right? I needed discipline to be able to, I didn't have anybody except Old Man Winter kind of chasing me to get things done on my house. I needed to learn how to do that. And at the end of the day, nobody can take that away from me, what I've done there. If the house, burns down or for some reason it gets taken in eminent domain or something. You can never really take away the hard muscles that I got from lifting everything or the strong brain from figuring things. And certainly that gives me a confidence that no matter what happens, I'll always have. I live in my conception.
Yeah.
I live in an idea that I had.
It didn't take you 30 years to pay it off either.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, you know. I did sweat equity. So I'm especially young people, and I hope there's some young people in the audience hearing this. You know, you don't have to follow the path that everyone has told you, which was, you know, go to school and get good grades and go to college and take out a bunch of debt and then get a house with a mortgage and take out more debt and get, you know, maybe you can get a good job and maybe at 70, if everything goes perfectly, you can retire. There are other ways to do things. And they will give you benefits, not just in the house. Like, it's great. People ask what the house is worth, and I say, whatever you pay in rent every month. That's what the house is worth. Whatever your mortgage is every month, that's what my house is worth every month because I don't pay it. There are other ways of existing and living here, and I think we're going to need to find those if we're to be successful in the 21st century.
Well, what do you in Detroit now, what, I don't know, what do you have a vision of what Detroit will or should look like in, say, 10 years, or what would you like to see? Because a lot of people, the headlines are very positive right now. Mm-hmm. Travel Michigan is talking about it, it's making top 10 lists,
that's
but
good.
It's the downtown district.
Sure.
It's the restaurants, the stadiums, the riverfront, the linear park along the river, but getting outside of that, there's another 140 square miles
Sure. Of
maybe neighborhoods like yours that are, you know, coming back. But we need. So, what do you think should be done?
So, I'm not necessarily the person to decide what should be done. Like a young white person that's moved in there, right? What I don't want to do is do what we've always done before. I do not want to make the same mistakes of the past. And I suppose in some of our decisions, like the one with the hockey stadium that I mentioned earlier, we're making some of the same mistakes of the past. I want to try something new. This is a new century. And we get to decide what that is. We don't have to do it how we did it before. We don't have to follow that same model. We can come up with whatever we want. And I think we need to have some difficult, but I think fruitful conversations amongst ourselves about who we want to be as a people. And our politicians should not lead these conversations. And I say that honestly, you know. Thank you. We need to have these conversations without the greed and the avarice that goes on. And we can do it, too. I think that in some ways we forgot how powerful we are as citizens and individuals of this country. You know, I get to speak in a lot of places like this, and I look around and I see brilliant, caring people that aren't nearly as divided as mm-hmm. we talk about. I think that's manufactured, and I think we have to remember, we put a man on the moon.
Right.
I mean, think about that. Like, really, like, think about it. Like, for me, it's incredible. People have been looking up at the moon forever. And the United States did that. And we can't figure out healthcare? Come on. Like, honestly, you know? Like, we can do it. There is sometimes a defeatism which has infected us a little bit. And I don't think that's metastasizing or spreading. I think that we can really look at who we want to be, and I think that we can really come to terms with that.
I tell you, your generation has, I hope they stop imitating who's come before them and look at ideas and say, we can do anything we want now.
Sure.
You have new technology and all kinds of ideas. So the old Detroit you mentioned was the home of the first middle class, thanks to the auto industry jobs,
sure.
which is, it's still there, but it's not what it used to be, nor will it ever probably.
Sure.
Gilbert is downtown with the mortgage place. What's that?
Quicken Loans.
I don't know if CompuWare is still down there, but can Detroit be something that offers a place to live for people without a core industry, do you think?
I think we don't want to have mono industry again,
yeah.
right? So that's one of the mistakes I don't think we want to repeat. I think we want to have a diverse industry. With that said, there's no reason Detroit can't be solar panel city. There's no reason Detroit can't be windmill city. We have a large manufacturing base still with a lot of people that need jobs and understand how manufacturing works. And I don't think there's any reason we can't subsidize the hell out of green energy and do it right in Detroit.
Yeah, it could be the entrepreneur capital too.
Absolutely.
You could just say, if you have an idea for a business, come here and do it.
And this is one, and this is, like I'm saying, this is just one idea, and I'm not the only person that should or can decide what that needs to be. We need to have a conversation, because I'm only one mind. There's a lot of other brilliant people, but we have to support that. We have to, as both a society and our governments, have to support and put money behind those things instead of just giving it to billionaires.
One other notable part of your story, I just get a kick out of when you moved, or when you obtained your house, which you went in ahead of time before you even owned it and tried to close it up, which not exactly legal. You had to be careful about that. But did you get building permits, by the way, to do all your work?
So I do pay my taxes, and no, I do not.
This is a
tough subject, right? So I what I say is, when the city starts pulling its weight in the neighborhood, I will start pulling permits. If I can't get a cop to come to my house, I have to take care of myself. I don't feel like I'm, because there's so much empty space, I don't feel like I'm endangering anybody, except for myself and my family. But when I can't get the police to come.
But part of the trash that you removed, for people who didn't read the book, and I just get a kick out of this, it's something so genuinely Detroit about it. The trash that you removed from your house, 10,000 pounds or so, included part of a stolen vehicle?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a Dodge Caravan cut into chunks with a reciprocating saw in there. So what that probably was, the neighbors told me it was like an insurance job. So somebody needed the money and reported their car stolen and paid a couple of guys to cut it up. And most of it made it into my house.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't read the book, I would heartily recommend it. Let's give it up for Drew. I mean, for not only for what he did with the house. If he didn't write the book, that would be such a great accomplishment, but none of us would know it. So we have the book, and it's inspiring and is making a difference, I'm sure.
Thank you.
That was Drew Philp talking with Ron Jolly. Drew Philp's book is called A $500 House in Detroit. Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.